Coming up today, eBay has been hacked. The moon has a faster broadband connection than many parts of the UK, and Twitter is censoring tweets deemed to be blasphemous in Pakistan. We'll also be talking about Facebook's attempts to eavesdrop on our TV watching, and talking about the role, or lack thereof, that Call of Duty played in the recent suicides of four teenagers. All that and more coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to laser aphrodisiacs and moral panic about video games. I'm your host, Olivia Solon, and I'm the deputy editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Leanne Clark.
And I'm Katie Collins.
And we are all slowly being driven mad by the drilling that's taking place next to our office.
My computer vibrated today.
I hope you can't hear it because it's a nightmare for us, so it must be annoying for you
too. It's kind of like soul penetrating, like we can. It's kind of bone conduction sound that we're hearing.
But every time I feel it, you know, it's just like in Godzilla when, you know, or Jurassic Park when the water...
Katie's got a glass of water.
That's what happens in Jurassic Park. The water vibrates and, you know, T-Rex is coming.
Yeah. Again, we have no Nate this week, but we just had a tweet come in from a guy called Barry Pollard who said there's been no Nate on the podcast since the launch of a 24-hour cat TV channel. Causation or correlation? I think that's a very good point, Barry.
Interesting.
I'm sure we'll find out in the coming weeks. But we'll be hearing lots more from our listeners at the end of the show in the feedback loop. But let's get cracking with the news. Now, if you use eBay and you haven't already changed your password, you probably should now.
Yes, indeed. So last week it came to light that there was a large-scale hack of eBay's user database. And this was a database that contained customer names, dates of birth, full contact details, and probably most worryingly of all, encrypted passwords. Now, when eBay discovered this, it had already happened 2 to 3 months ago. And they discovered it recently, and in all fairness to them, they did inform people as soon as they kind of found out about it. But what that means is that there's a chance that hackers may have had a chance to decrypt the passwords or use some of the information that they found, although there hasn't actually been any evidence that that's happened so far. So don't panic too much, but do change your passwords to eBay now.
I must say, I only just got an email from eBay saying change your password days after the event.
That's another thing. So you should also change your passwords to any other accounts that might share your eBay password. But a third thing you need to worry about is that apparently scammers have been sending out emails which are purportedly from eBay and have been attempting to get people to click on links to go and change their password, fake links.
Oh my God, I did this today.
Which just shows that there are baddies everywhere.
Wait a minute, I did this today, are you joking?
Did you change your password using it?
Yeah, I couldn't even remember what my old one was.
So, everybody, be careful. there are people out there trying to get us, but don't worry, we'll help you through it. And the other people that are trying to help you through it are the Information Commissioner's Office, which is the UK watchdog for kind of data issues. And along with the Federal Trade Commission in the US and a bunch of states, they want to investigate this. In order to do this, they're going to have to coordinate efforts with Luxembourg's Data Protection Authority, because that's where eBay has its European base. But yeah, and they kind of, all they can say for now is that they don't even know if any UK residents have been affected, but reiterate the advice from eBay.
That does sound like the most toothless crack team of investigators right there. You know, like the data protection team, we're coming to get you.
Yeah.
Watch out, guys. But there's something else has been found out today, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is not the end of this saga. A security researcher who is actually a 19-year-old college student from Stockton-on-Tees called Jordan Lee Jones said that he has found a second flaw, and he alerted eBay about this, but it hasn't been acknowledged or fixed. So he posted it on the internet, which reminds me a little bit. Do you remember when a similar thing happened with Facebook, and a researcher found a flaw, and because he was ignored by Facebook, posted it on Mark Zuckerberg's page?
Yes.
So obviously this isn't necessarily ideal, and eBay does discourage it, but there's nothing technically illegal about doing this.
So what's, hang on, what is the flaw?
The flaw is that apparently it's a cross-site scripting flaw, which means that code from another source has been executed within the website. And it means that if logged in users click on any page that has been injected with the attack code, the cookie from the page the hacker can then grab, and it will be emailed automatically to them, which will have connected to it all that, all the users' account information. So obviously this has kind of just been discovered, and eBay has yet to respond to this. But yeah, it seems like it's bigger than it was than initially we thought it was, and this, it may well go down as one of the biggest kind of data protection problems that has kind of occurred so far since we started using the internet. So,
well, we've had things like the Sony PlayStation Network, and then there was a LinkedIn vulnerability, but this is pretty major. eBay is, what, you know, yeah, much bigger than both of those. So
it's got millions of worldwide kind of active users, so,
and all their bank details,
yes,
or PayPal details.
Although as far as we know, PayPal hasn't been affected, so yeah.
I must say, I'm actually sweating about the fact that I followed that email link today.
Do you want to
And check? Changed it to the password that I use for
everything else.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll be keeping you informed about the latest news on this eBay vulnerability and whether or not Liat has just been fallen foul of a phishing attack. Fingers crossed she hasn't, but I'm sure we'll find out at the end of the podcast if you've had your bank account cleared out. Now, lots of things get us in the mood for sex. I'm thinking low lighting, music, oysters, champagne. But if you're a fly, it could be lasers.
Yeah.
Liat.
Could be lasers for you one day, even, Liv.
I hope so.
If people make life easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, yes. So a team of neuroscientists and geneticists have decided to toy with the mind of the humble fruit fly and get it to court a ball of plasticine using lasers. Mount it, yeah.
Well, I'm imagining it going up and going, oh, hello, would you like a drink?
Well, actually,
go to the cinema.
They do have quite a long-winded courtship procedure.
Okay.
Involves what some people refer to as dancing, but it basically stalks the female in circles, taps her, then vibrates its wings, kind of singing, and then licks her nether regions and then goes in for the kill.
Well, not the kill.
Yeah, sorry, I just had to tell you the whole thing.
Okay.
Because it's relevant to the story, guys.
Right, well, those are some spoilers, guys. But let's go back to the beginning.
Okay, so this was all done in the name of science to test a new thermogenetics technique. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but it's similar to optogenetics, where you're basically controlling neural activity using external stimulus. You basically genetically modify specific neurocells to respond, in this case, to heat. Obviously, with optogenetics, it's with light. So this team have come up with the nifty named fly mind altering device to test this. And so basically, thermogenetics has a few problems, as does optogenetics when it comes to fruit flies. With mice, you might actually stick optic fibers straight into the brain. And obviously with a fruit fly, you just can't be doing with wires.
Too small a brain, too big a wire.
Exactly. So you need very, very accurate laser systems. And that is what they're presenting here. Using real-time high-res video tracking, they could basically target the fly far more precisely with the laser. And they used infrared laser. Normally they would use red light lasers for heat. I think it's something like 30 degrees they need to get to. And the infrared laser actually penetrates more deeply and so therefore would be more accurate and wouldn't kind of, you know, give rise to visual responses from the fly if it's kind of coloured red light. So according to them, this accuracy has now been improved to within a fraction of a second. And they know this because they made it mount that ball of plasticine.
Can I just ask why they made it mount a ball of plasticine, of all things?
I really don't know.
Why not another fly?
Well, it all took place in a box, and I guess they just didn't want to confuse the video tracking with another moving object.
That's plonked a plasticine ball instead. So hang on, we've explained that the light is interfering with some brain activity, and we've explained that the end result is humping a ball of plasticine. But what are they messing around with in the fly's brain to make that happen?
The neurons, specific...
What are they targeting?
So, in this case, they targeted several neurons that we already know, or we think we know, are involved in the mating process. But according to this team of neuroscientists, you know, we don't actually specifically know. We have kind of causality, but there's no direct proof. And this is what they're trying to deliver here. So two specific neurons they were focusing on testing. One of them, they found out, is responsible for a persistent state of contact. They delicately referred it to
horniness.
You keep being horny for a while. You keep the mate. I mean, it's a long Viagra mating procedure, so they continue
Viagra.
That.
Viagra.
Exactly. And they found this out because they were able, when they shone the laser on P1 neuron, after the laser was redirected, the fly was active, shall we say, for several minutes afterwards.
And so that's when the dance starts, the licking starts, the fly wing, the whole shebang, really.
But they've also targeted a neuron that was directly responsible for the singing, which is the wing vibrations, basically. Because when they moved the laser this time around, it stopped singing immediately. Aww. So they know they could just switch it on and off. Good. Wouldn't that be nice as well? So they're looking to kind of do it with multiple flies next time. I don't know what that'll involve. Perhaps not courting.
Perhaps not plasticine.
Perhaps not plasticine.
Yeah. And so what's this ultimately going to tell us?
It's going to tell us all about the brain, Liv. Understanding what specific activities, specific neural cells are responsible for and contribute to is obviously, you know, one little bit of a giant maze that is the brain.
There are lots of people who complain about the lack of broadband or the terrible speeds of broadband in rural areas of the UK. So it will come as little comfort to discover that researchers are able to give the moon, which is 340,000 kilometres away, a pretty decent broadband connection. Katie?
Yes, that's right. So the moon doesn't necessarily have the kind of water and food and the buildings that we perhaps need to live in yet, but it does have a great internet connection.
Yeah.
Reliable wireless internet is probably one of the things that people don't want to be without these days. But MIT and NASA have demonstrated that data communication technology is actually capable of beaming internet to the moon in a way that can provide the same kind of connectivity that we enjoy on Earth. So that means facilitating large data transfers, streaming high definition video, that kind of thing. And it's quite a complicated process. Basically, it involves one laser transmitter that beams coded pulses of infrared light into four separate telescopes. And these are all based in New Mexico at the moment. And they then beam uplink signals into space. And each of the telescopes beams it through a slightly different column of air, which means that they bend in different ways in the hope that one will hit a receiver attached to a satellite that's currently orbiting the moon. This all sounds a bit kind of hit and miss to me. just kind of pointing four beams and hoping that one ends up in the right place. But apparently it does work. And all that's needed to create a reliable connection is less than a billionth of a watt. And each of the telescopes transmits 40 watts, I think. And a billionth of the watt is 10 times more than is needed, actually, for a reliable internet connection. So the team have actually found that they can transmit the data between Earth and the moon at a rate of 19.44 megabits per second, which is faster than probably many people enjoy on earth.
Yeah, well, actually, according to Ofcom, the average fixed line broadband speed in the UK is 17.8 megabits per second. So it is faster than the average. And super fast broadband is considered anything over 30 megabits per second. So 20 doesn't sound too bad to me.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of sort of feedback on Twitter and that kind of thing, people saying, you know, complaining about their own internet connections. And it's kind of understandable that they'd be frustrated by this news. The technology is clearly there and capable of transmitting data over that huge distance. And yet they might live 50 miles away from the nearest city and they can't get a reliable internet connection. So, yeah, that could be very... frustrating, but they might be even more frustrated to hear the fact that this system has been designed with the moon in mind. It could actually be used in deep space missions, so it could be used to actually transmit similar kind of data speeds up to Mars and other planets as well.
Ouch.
Yeah.
One does have to wonder how much it costs to do to achieve those data speeds. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure your $15.99 or whatever you spend on broadband is going to quite cut it.
Yeah, those four telescopes have got to be expensive to run.
Blasphemy is not a topic we discuss all that often on the Wired podcast, but censorship is. And this week we've got a story that combines both.
Yes, Olivia. The New York Times delivered us this little treat, revealing that Twitter has actually honoured five requests made from a guy called Abdul Batin inside Pakistan's telecommunications authority. He wanted them to censor tweets and accounts considered blasphemous and unethical. Now, obviously, Twitter introduced a new set of terms and conditions that said basically they would adhere to individual country laws and censor content accordingly. It doesn't mean that the content would be blocked everywhere, but it would be blocked within that country. So in this case, it was related to crude drawings of the Prophet Muhammad, photos of burning Qurans, and tweets from a US porn star and anti-Islam bloggers. Now, I think this has been happening in other countries, but it's the first time it's happened in Pakistan. And some of the other kind of more high-profile cases are things like in Germany blocking a neo-Nazi party, I believe, maybe last year or the year before. So this is something that a lot of social networks do. Facebook does the same thing. But, you know, there's obviously concerns that it could extend beyond this and that actually they might be preempting certain things.
Blasphemy is then illegal in Pakistan. Is that the point here?
Yes, it is. Yeah. So in Pakistan, the blasphemy laws are really, really strict as they are. And increasingly, recently, there have been a lot of cases where people have been really persecuted for going against these laws. There've been lots of killings and sort of witch hunts and things, and so and they're being
persecuted.
The laws are being implemented in a way that they haven't been before, I think.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this happens in obviously a lot of countries in the world. There's a high profile case this week of the woman, is it in Sudan, where she's been sentenced to death for marrying a Christian and basically rejecting her faith. Which is illegal there. And it seems crazy to us, but this is the law of the country. And Twitter is saying it has to abide by national laws, of course. Otherwise, simply the government would not allow them to operate there. And the argument is, you know, it's better than being blocked completely and completely limiting free speech. So I think it's obviously quite a tricky one, but it's supposed to be a very, you know, a very diligent process where someone with authority reports it and it's investigated and then the content's taken down. But in this report from the New York Times, they're claiming that some accounts were not blocked after complaints and investigation, but actually preemptively before something called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day, which is something that started a couple years ago. And you can imagine, like, Twitter is just full of these pictures. So I don't know. I mean, in Turkey, you know, Turkey decided to basically try and block Twitter completely because it didn't like what was coming up. And Twitter kind of conceded to bits and pieces there, where politicians were complaining about invasion of privacy when videos were going online and photos and documents, which were basically accusing them of serious crimes and corruption, which, you know, you could in this country, if you put a video on and it was false, you could say it's libelous and it's damaging and it's invasion of privacy. So that, to a certain extent, I don't know, Twitter's obviously in a difficult position. And obviously we would, I don't know, in this country, not agree with that. But there are a lot of countries that, you know, it's illegal to badmouth the royals and you'll be put in jail for that. And what does Twitter do in those instances? It seems so ridiculous to us, but how can they operate in a country and not abide by its rules?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's one kind of situation where it's blocking neo-Nazi parties, which I'm sure most people would agree is a good thing because it's stopping people from spreading hate speech and spreading kind of dangerous ideas. But then where do you draw the line with that? And
but that's against the law in Germany.
Yeah.
But, so that's in law.
But then again, I think that it's worrying in Pakistan that this is happening now at the same time that the kind of the government authorities are implementing this blasphemy law in a more kind of vicious and dangerous way for its citizens, and that those two things have kind of coincided.
I also find it a bit odd that, you know, whenever there's, if you cast our mind back to the Arab Spring, as it's called, Twitter made a lot of effort to allow people to use the social networking site, the microblogging site, when governments tried to take it down. So there are times when Twitter is a big advocate for free speech, but at other times it's, you know, bowing down to other regimes and censoring content. And I don't know what the policy is there.
I guess the Arab Spring was a really specific case where the public had something to say. It wasn't like we are breaking specific laws. They were just wanted to, you know, they wanted to show the world what was happening.
But it's taking a political decision in doing that, in allowing in insisting that they create new ways that people can post to Twitter.
It's taking a political one, but it's not breaking any local laws.
I know that Twitter has an external company that it basically employs to make sure that it's doing this transparently and that it's letting people know and that it's kind of going through the requests that come in from governments and kind of analysing them properly and that kind of thing. But I think there have been complaints from people that this authority, the Pakistan Telecommunication Authority, and the kind of the bureaucrat within it is not maybe the right person or the right organisation to be telling Twitter that these accounts need to be taken down.
What do you think about Twitter censoring tweets according to local law? Let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. Now that's all the news we've got this week, but still to come, why does Facebook want to listen to what you're watching on TV? And is it fair that video games are being blamed for teenage suicides?
Do you want a free audiobook? You probably do since you're listening to our podcast. Audible.co.uk is offering every listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast any book from its catalogue of 80,000, including the latest science, technology and business releases from best-selling authors, just for trying out its service. A one-month trial of Audible.co.uk costs nothing, and whatever book you choose to download is yours to keep, even if you cancel your account. Head to audible.co.uk/wired, where you can sign up in a few seconds to download any book you want. You'll be supporting Nate, Olivia, Liat and the rest of the Wired.co.uk podcast team, and you get a free book in return. Sign up easily now at audible.co.uk/wired. Thanks for supporting the show. That's audible.co.uk/wired.
Welcome back. Now we are going to go into our first discussion segment for the week, and I've already put on my hard hat and jodhpurs, and I've put an enormous bridle and saddle on my steed, and now it's time to ride the Technosaurus. Yes, that was a Technosaurus that was causing the vibrations in Katie's drink of water earlier. Now, this week, there's been quite a bit of discussion about Facebook's latest update for its apps, and it's introducing a tool that will listen in and identify the TV shows that you're watching and the music that you're listening in your home or wherever you are, in order to make it easier to join online discussions about the entertainment that you're enjoying. Now, this involves audio fingerprinting technology, and it means that you don't have to look for a particular hashtag for a show or find the page where everyone's talking about it. You can just click a button on your Facebook mobile app and it will, like Shazam, listen to the show you're watching and then link your comments about it to the right online discussion. Now, Facebook has spent a year developing this audio sampling system, and it's kind of interesting because it logs not only the TV show you're watching, but the season and the episode data when you post to Facebook. And with music, it will specify the band, the track, and the album, and it will even show a 30-second clip if people choose to include it in an update. And this will all be included in the next Facebook app update. So if you don't like it, I'd suggest you don't update your Facebook app. Now, the aim of this is to claw back some of your attention while you're watching TV and movies. Now, this is where Twitter seems to dominate. I mean, we often see hashtags on TV screens as we're watching, and the discussion tends to take place there, at least in my household it does. And Tumblr's also been trying to get in on the action. But it also, at least according to Facebook, makes it easier to share what you're watching without having to type out a long program name or search for relevant hashtags.
Oh, how arduous.
How arduous.
Do you really do this when you're watching films as well, or just TV shows?
I will, if I'm watching a film that I've enjoyed, or if, no, if I've watched a film, I'll say I've watched it.
Yeah, I but like during it, you want to enjoy it.
But TV shows, I'm regularly looking up actors and who's that? I want to know who that is.
I've seen them before in something.
Well, yeah, exactly. Tweet them.
But anyway, what's the real reason that Facebook is doing this?
Money.
Exactly, Liat. As you can expect, the answer is, of course, advertising revenue. If Facebook can show that people are watching shows and then talking about them on Facebook, it might help to encourage their advertisers to think about also targeting people on the social networking site. TV is still where advertisers spend the vast majority of their money. It's very expensive, and lots of digital companies are looking at it and thinking, I want a slice of that pie. Yeah. But until now, the link between you watching TV and you talking about stuff online hasn't been made explicit. They can obviously tell if you're writing about something on Facebook at the time when a show is being aired, but obviously we have a lot of time-shifted viewing these days. Mm. So that link isn't always clear, at least on a kind of chronological basis. But this kind of creates a tangible way of linking the content that's being viewed on your TV screen with the conversations you're having online. And that means Facebook can go to the advertiser and say, look, all those people who are potentially ignoring the ad break where your car ad is appearing are talking actively on Facebook about the same show while your ad break is running. So why don't you target them
that,
with advertising?
During the adverts. But otherwise it feels like they're kind of transplanting something that's naturally happened on Twitter.
I think just because it's also happening on Twitter doesn't mean it can't happen on Facebook too, if there's money to be made. But what do you think? I mean, is this creepy? Do we want this?
I don't think it's creepy because you opt to have it, don't you?
It doesn't automatically happen. You have to press a button and you say, listen to this TV show. Yeah. So it's when you're too lazy to type with your chubby fingers, you just press a button and it'll say, oh, I'm listening in for 30 seconds, and then like Shazam, it will identify what the program is, and you can say, okay, post that, I'm watching it.
Yeah, I think supremely lazy. I think that in using Facebook, you would want to talk about these things with your friends, so you might post something anyway. Like on Twitter, it happens naturally because everyone's in on the conversation. I can't imagine being redirected to like people having an online forum chat about it on a fan page on Facebook, actually engaging with those people.
The other alternative is that it also offers is just being able to post, this is the show I'm watching right now, easily.
And I think that is something that people will probably be more likely to take advantage of than
quick and easy,
like you say, like chatting with strangers. Although, you know, that does happen on Twitter.
Yeah.
When people are kind of using a hashtag
on Twitter,
and that kind of thing. But I think I agree with what you're saying about creating a sort of a false environment for this discussion to take place in.
But
like
I think
a separate channel.
That false environment is what's particularly valuable to Facebook. If they can link all those people who are talking about the same show, whether or not those people are actually talking to each other in new ways, it's still a value to Facebook to know.
Absolutely.
We've got X number of people watching this episode at this time.
But you know, like when there's a really popular video and it's been posted on Facebook and you dare to click on it, or a photo, and there's like 35,000 comments from absolute fruitcakes and like usually bigots and sexist people.
And they can do that
I wouldn't
easily
want to chat
because it's
them.
The same link to that video. So it's someone's posted that one link and that's been shared and shared and shared and shared. But the problem is people are talking about the last episode of Hannibal on different ways, typing it out in different, you know, making lots of different spelling mistakes. And all those conversations, you know, you might be shared virally by 100 people in one place, but it's not all aggregated, and that's of less value to Facebook and its data guzzling ways.
Less value to Facebook, perhaps not less value to people.
Well, that's a good
so
point.
It makes me wonder if this is going to be a little bit like check-ins, where perhaps it's something at first that people are like, ooh, a new thing that I can use, a new button I can press to let everybody know I'm doing this. And then over time, everyone's like, oh, actually, this is a bit annoying. Yes. I'm going to stop checking in everywhere I go.
Oh, my God. Or you just can just imagine. Yes. Yeah. So annoying. Can you imagine your news feed is just like, I'm in the business class lounge and I'm watching Hannibal. I don't know.
I think the former part of that sentence would be more irritating than the latter.
Yeah. I was trying to think of something, but I was looking at you, Liv. So I could only think of Hannibal.
Oh, God, I thought you were looking at me because of business class. Definitely not. But the interesting thing about this, people have been kicking up a bit of a fuss this week saying, oh, no, Facebook, you know, invading our privacy yet again. And I guess, you know, it is a step change in terms of it accessing your microphone on your device. That's something that I don't think Facebook has been able to do before. But Google's been doing this for ages. Google's virtual assistant, Google Now, has been able to listen to TV and identify what you're watching for almost a year now. As long as the device you're using is connected to the same Wi-Fi network as your smart TV, it will recognize what you're watching and then deliver kind of ancillary content. So if you're watching Hannibal, it'll deliver you information about the actors, or it might mention a certain name and you can look that person up, and it provides this kind of slides of information. But what's interesting in Google's context is it creates an opportunity for a sort of audio AdWord, whereby you can imagine in the future, perhaps if a car is mentioned on the TV show, that keyword of a car could be linked to a brand. So Audi, for example, might want to pay to be associated every time someone's talking about a car or driving a car on the TV show.
Nightmare. Do I want to look at my phone in the middle of a film and interrupt my viewing experience just so I can see a car advert? No.
Well, I mean, I'm definitely already looking at my phone a lot of the time, but it would be in the same way that sponsored links on search results come up alongside the right-hand side of your Google page. It would be more like that. So you might be looking up the actor and whether or not he appeared in Saved by the Bell. And then next door, it might have, you know, a bell company.
So it's all right, guys. You're just going to ignore this added content like you ignore all the other annoying adverts.
Yeah, and Google's going to make money out of it.
For some bizarre reason, advertisers are going to pay.
Yeah, I think kind of if you're going to go down the creepy route and be annoyed about Facebook accessing your microphone and stuff, we know for a fact that they're already accessing way more information that's way, way more personal than listening to what you're watching on TV.
And you say they're accessing, we're volunteering the information. Mm. So, yeah, whether or not you're listening to a true detective.
We're just listing all of Liv's favourite shows.
I'm not Saved by the Bell.
Saved by the Bell.
But what do you think? Do you think it's creepy? Are you just kind of over the idea of privacy altogether? Please let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Privacy is so 20th century.
Now, our second and last segment for today is going to get a lot of people very riled. So brace yourselves for What the Actual Flip. What the... Video games have been blamed for a lot of societal ills, but this week they're being held responsible for teen suicides. Liat.
Yeah.
What the actual flip?
I know. It's a bit of a shocker, really. And in fairness, I mean, the headlines have basically said, like, Call of Duty linked to 4 suicides. They've not been linked to 4 suicides. A coroner, in his delivering an open verdict into the death of a 16-year-old boy at an inquest, has called into question Call of Duty's impact after having 4 cases come past his docket where all suicides have been huge fans of Call of Duty. He's called that up and he has said it concerns me greatly. He said it has figured in a number of deaths which I'm investigating. I suspect, but I don't know because I don't have enough evidence, that William may have been experimented with something or deliberately intending to do something, but we haven't got the evidence. So in this statement, to explain a little bit, he was found in his room asphyxiated with his hands tied behind his back. He'd been having a nice day with his family. Everyone said he was a very happy boy. There's no rhyme or reason to it. And in that sentence, the coroner has just linked him being a fan of Call of Duty, other suicides among teenage boys, all being fans of Call of Duty, and the fact that he was doing something very unusual. As with anyone being presented with like a tragic death of a teenager, you're trying to find an answer to something. You really saw it during the inquest, family members kind of attesting to him being a happy teen, a straight A student, very normal, into video games, badminton, art, that they're painting the picture of, you know, a average teenager.
Hang on, why is no one calling into question badminton?
Yes, well, exactly, absolutely. I mean, there was like this mention of his father giving him a copy of Never Let Me Go, which is like a really dark dystopian book, and his brother mentioned that he admired a philosopher who coincidentally took his own life, but none of that was called up on. Call of Duty was called up on. This coroner has decided he's seen four kids that routinely watch it, but step back for a minute and look at the probabilities of a teenage boy who has committed suicide owning a copy of Call of Duty.
Okay.
Number one. Like, I mean, Call of Duty is routinely in the top five of national sales charts. There's been so many games and they, you know, most of them have been in like the top three. Yes, many of them have an 18 rating, but I think there's one this year that's 16. But what's that based on? Like, why are only over 18s allowed to play Call of Duty when, say, at 16 years old, you're allowed to actually go to war and see actual blood and guts spill out on the battlefield? I have no idea. It seems ridiculous. Also, suicide stats in the UK. Male suicides vastly outnumber female. In 2012, 4,590 suicide victims were male and just 1,391 were female. So,
and a lot of young men as well. I mean, there's, I think, young men, it's the second highest cause of death after car accidents. Is
whoa.
That
that's awful. I mean, and asphyxiation is the number one method. Like, suffocation and hanging is apparently the most popular method. But it's like due to access. I mean, you have to always look at causation. And I mean, I spoke to an Oxford professor about this who's published a study earlier this year stating that it's actually the difficulty in games, not violence, that causes people to become aggressive. And he said the coroner's statement was basically the same as saying a teenage boy who committed suicide did so wearing jeans. Like, the probability of him wearing jeans and owning a copy of Call of Duty are probably quite similar. It's such a popular game.
Or really liking chocolate.
Yeah. And I mean,
beer.
Well, exactly. And there's correlations all over the place if you're looking for them. There's no causation. There is no evidence for this. There are no studies saying that games lead to self-harm. And on the flip side, games leading to violent behaviour, there's people in both camps constantly arguing about it. But there's no scientific evidence.
So why did the coroner then bring this whole debate up?
Well, I think, you know, obviously with any tragedy, you try and look for an answer. And there was just, it was very, all the wording from people was he was normal. He was happy. He was a normal teenager. He did not seem depressed. And it was kind of a comment on, well, I mean, the fact that we have high suicide rates and we have high male suicide rates, a lot of people suggest it's because men are not as comfortable talking about how they feel as women, which is obviously a vast sweeping statement. But, you know, it's almost as if because he didn't come up to anyone and say, I'm going through this, he couldn't have been depressed.
So it must have been Call of Duty.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, it is ridiculous. It's ridiculous, and it's sad that that is kind of, that is the focus of all these news stories, that it's Call of Duty. You know, you forget what the boy's name was. You forget that this is a 16-year-old boy that's like died in tragic circumstances, and his parents have to sit at an inquest and listen to a coroner warn about letting your children who are under 18 watch video games, essentially blaming them for letting their child play something which every teenage boy at school is probably playing. And something that, you know, he's probably see more violence in, well, not more violence in movies, but, you know, just as much watching video games with your parents. And I mean, I don't know, were your parents ever strict on these types of things? And do you think there was ever any concerns about what you were exposed to?
Absolutely not.
No.
I sometimes watched a few scary movies that I had nightmares from, but nothing that I feel has damaged me irrevocably.
Me too, exactly. When you think about it, when we were younger, there was probably like much more about violent movies and violent behavior than violent video movies. Games. And it's just that video games are super popular now. It's like the latest, you know, technology to bring fear into older generations.
I'm trying to think of video games, like Wolfenstein was kind of jumpy, and then stuff like GoldenEye used to get really anxious watching,
oh me too,
anxious playing, but I do appreciate that video games do in some ways glorify violence. I don't think any more than something like a Quentin Tarantino movie does.
Yeah, it's, I mean, that's kind of obscene violence.
Fiction and it's entertainment.
This argument always kind of pops up whenever there's any violent unusual activity. And Andres Breivik, I believe there were stories everywhere that he had,
he was the guy in Norway who murdered dozens of kids.
School children, and he apparently trained, you know, played Call of Duty a lot, practicing. He's also completely deluded and, you know,
a psychopath.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when it comes back to the argument about depression and kind of video games and depression, there are so many arguments as well that kind of turn it completely on its head. I've got a very good friend, Danny O'Dwyer, who works for GameSpot and made a fantastic documentary about video games and depression, and about how people had often used video games to help them through those tough times.
Absolutely. And why is it always, you know, a kid is spending too much time in his room playing video games? Why is the answer he's obviously lonely, or like has social problems, or is, you know, got some kind of abuse going
on? All your friends,
maybe he just loves it. Like, maybe he just really, really enjoys it. And he's a teenager. Surprise, surprise, he doesn't want to talk to his parents all the evening. He wants to sit in his room and play. He could be doing anything up there. You just think he's playing games. You know what teenage boys also like to do. But also, I mean, the professor I spoke to, he was saying, you know, people like to blame things that seem tangible to blame, obviously, like any kind of media, social media, or like whether it's a technology or something. You can't switch off, you know, huge social problems like poverty or, you know, child abuse. You can't control any of those things, but you can stamp an age rating on something. You can say that you must ban this or stop this.
I suppose it's similar when people blame Facebook for bullying or cyberbullying or that kind of thing. And ultimately, that's just kind of the delivery method. It's actually the kind of the bullying that does the harm, no matter what form it comes in. Mm. I think it's been proven that for a lot of teenage suicides, they're often kind of caused by spotting things in the media, perhaps kind of copycat situations. And
but then hang on, if you're saying that there are things that influence you in the media, then why would you not be influenced by the video games that you're playing?
I think that it's specifically being aware that other people perhaps are killing themselves that are your age.
I see.
That's the kind of the thing that's been proven.
Okay.
But also, yeah, the media makes it, some of these awful things sound very common, and media portrayals that are a much more kind of nefarious way of influencing someone than I choose to play it, pick up a game and play it because I enjoy it. You're having messages kind of thrown at you from the media, but a game you're engaging in and you're choosing to do it, and it's just something you and your friends enjoy and maybe play together. But there was one, I don't know if this was like some stats that this professor pulled out, but he was saying, you know, if you show a picture of a goth to a person in the street and ask them if they're a Satanist or a Christian, like more often than not, they say Satanist. And that is despite there being like 1.5 billion Christians in the world or whatever. Like there's no, it's quite unlikely that this person's a Satanist. There aren't many Satanists around, but because of how a group of people are portrayed, that assumption is taken on board. There's no scientific evidence to say that playing a video game would cause self-harm, and yet here we have national headlines.
So what do you think about the way that the media portrays video game violence, and in this case, portraying it as a contributor to suicide? Please let us know on podcast@wired.co.uk. Now, we are about to enter into the feedback loop, our segment where we talk about all the lovely emails and tweets that we've had from you guys.
So last week we spoke about lab meat and whether it was the future of our protein intake, having little factors factories of lab meat adjoining to every village and every town in the country. And Bobby C said, "Hi, ladies, and Nate, if he bothers to show up. So you mentioned about lab-grown meat on the podcast, and I thought it'd be interesting to link it to other trends we see, namely food printing. In the future, maybe we could have our own homemade labs in the same way craft ale and home brewing has taken off. So I'm going to be hosting a barbecue sometime in 2030, and all the sexy wild girls are invited." Thanks, Bobby. Yeah, I agree. There's a company actually that has a food 3D printer. I think, are they based in Barcelona?
But it only makes kind of odd, like crisp type things,
doesn't
it?
Really gross looking things, but maybe it's delicious.
Maybe it's delicious.
Texture is a challenge, as always.
Yeah, I like the idea of being able to kind of create really elaborate, like petit fours or something that's few ingredients but can be designed in a really cool way
and a really beautiful way. And regular listener Tom Webb chipped in to say he was pleased we brought up lab meat again. As a chocolate cricket muncher, he says, which didn't have much chocolate actually, I would be happy to eat this form of meat. I do feel a little guilty when I tuck into a bacon sandwich knowing some poor pig was killed for it. I love bacon sandwiches. I have even rescued spiders from the bath. I drowned them. Tom's a much better person than me. If this was executed properly, there would be less need for cows, says Tom, which then reduces all that energy to feed and look after so many of the methane leaking animals. Thanks again for a brilliant podcast this week. I agree with Tom. We should all live the way he does.
Oh, I thought you were agreeing with the fact that it was a brilliant podcast.
I agree with that too, Tom.
So, yeah, we've had another reader write in about a news story we discussed a few weeks ago, and that was that ISPs were going to start sending out naughty letters to people who infringe copyright. And Andrew Gold has written in to say, "I subscribe to Google Play. When I signed up to the service, it advertised that I would have access to all the music in the Google Play store. This month, I found out that I do not have access to all the music in the Google Play store library. I was highly anticipating listening to the latest Black Keys album. However, to stream the album through Google Play, I had to pay an additional $4.99. As Google Play is a streaming service, you do not get a digital copy. I mean, no MP3 file or anything. You just get the right to stream it. So I ended up downloading an illegal copy, which I never wanted to do. I'm a huge music fan and I don't want to download music illegally, but if I pay for a service like Google Play, I want it to be fair and equal. The whole experience has put me off subscribing to services like Google Play or Spotify. The Black Keys album was a big release. I'm sure I would not have been the only person disappointed." He goes on to complain about Google's customer service, saying that there is no complaints team you can talk to and that it makes Apple look like complete angels.
Ooh.
So, yeah, I mean, we can definitely understand the frustration here. Basically, quite often nowadays when you sign up to a service and you either expect to be able to access something, or even if you have access to something for a brief time, say on Netflix, and then they take it away.
Or Spotify takes away stuff the whole time.
And it can be really frustrating when you think you've basically paid for something and then it turns out actually that isn't quite included in what you had handed over your money for, and you can easily feel a bit shortchanged.
And finally, we have a piece of feedback from Joseph, aka the Hungarian social network guy. We all know the Hungarian social network guy, and he introduced us to a new cryptocurrency which is called Titcoins, and it's something that Pornhub has actually created. And he said, "I know you guys like bitcoins and porn, so maybe you should discuss this on your show." So I think we should discuss it. Do we need to pronounce this tit, tight, or tej coin?
Tej. Just like doge.
Yeah,
well, with tit.
There's a whole other can of worms opened. That's all we have time for this week, but we will look forward to penetrating your oral canals next week. Bye.
Bye. I thought you were going to say orifices or something.